Thanks, Trista, for joining me and chatting with me about what you're doing. Can you start by explaining to me your role as a futurist in the social sector?
Yeah, so I've been a philanthropic futurist for the last 10 years or so. And that just means that I help foundations and nonprofits and some social purpose business understand the trends that are coming that will impact their work. And I help them both learn how to predict and shape the future.
How did you get into this? Because I've read a bit about it in your wonderful book, Future Good. But if you can you share a little bit of that story, because it's an unusual role to be in.
For sure. So I was running a community foundation, and I had a post-it note on my computer once I got the job that said, learn how endowments work. So foundations have these endowments that dollars come out of it, and that's how they give grants. And I had no idea how endowments worked, but I was responsible for it. So it was one of my things I needed to learn about. And then just a couple months into the job, the stock market collapsed. So our endowment lost between 30 to 50% of its value.
Ouch.
And then suddenly we had to figure out what to do when our grantees desperately needed us, but we didn't have the money to do it. So I looked near and far and could not find any resources, and then found futurism as a tool to understand what's coming next so that we could help our grantees harness those trends. And as a result of that pivot, in just probably about a year or two, our grantees got 10 huge legislative wins on things like marriage equity and the first homeowners' bill of rights in the country. That wouldn't have happened if we didn't have that future lens.
So yeah, the idea of applying the futurism, which you talk about something that's used a lot in the military, and it's actually used a lot in big business that can, but taking that long term horizon view. So what you've done that is different in your area of expertise is saying, let's take this and let's apply it to philanthropic organizations and institutions and objectives.
Yeah, it's very powerful tools and normally just used to figure out what color shoes you're going to want to buy next year or what country's going to hate us next. So I think that for people that are trying to make the world a better place, they really need to have every single tool at their disposal possible. And so I act as that bridge between futurists that are doing amazing work but don't know much about nonprofits and foundations, and foundations and nonprofits that are doing phenomenal work but don't have a view into what's coming next.
Right. So this is a wonderful area of expertise, a wonderful niche that you have identified and owned. And one of the stories that you tell in your book is the work you did to try to build your platform and expertise, and specifically chasing down Richard Branson, which I think is which is such a fun story. I mean, it's a great idea of what's possible. Do you want to just share the highlights of that?
Yeah, for sure. So I had a fellowship that really was sort of an open study of what you need to develop as a leader. And they asked us, who do you want to get to know and sort of bring into your network during this fellowship? And so people are like, oh, there's this professor at the university that I want to learn from, or there's somebody in a different state that works at an organization like mine. And I knew that the fellowship was really a sort of once in a lifetime opportunity, and I was already really good at building networks. And so I wanted to set a hard goal so that I knew during this time period I have resources and support. Let me try to do something that I couldn't do on my own. And so my goal was to connect with Richard Branson because he has an amazing view on philanthropy. Everybody obviously only wants to ask him, how did you become so rich? But he's doing things to clean the ocean. He helped to develop a Marshall Plan around the Caribbean after Hurricane Maria to rebuild in a way that can be much more climate resilient. He's just working on really big things, and that is often rare for philanthropy. And so I wanted to connect with him. And so I told this fellowship network, like, that's my person. If you have a connection, let me know. And they all said, well, we don't have a Richard Branson connection for you. But he came to speak at a philanthropy conference just probably about 6 to 8 months later. And I can't tell you the number of emails that I got from people in my network that were like, he's going to speak at a thing that's connected to an organization that you know well, and I know you want to talk with him. So I think one of the pieces is to tell people in your network what you want and what you need and what you're looking for, because then they're extra sets of eyes, because I hadn't initially seen that opportunity. And so I reached out to the organization, which I had a great relationship with, and I reached out to their CEO and said, I am planning on interviewing Richard Branson during your conference. I want to make sure it doesn't interfere with anything that you have scheduled, and so let's coordinate. And because I had a strong brand and we had a good relationship, she didn't question whether I actually had an interview scheduled. So she sent me to the communications person, who very quickly realized that I did not have a plan nor a good connection, and said, you know, call me back when you figure it out. And so I had a great branding coach, Denise Brousseau, who I was working with, and she suggested that I write a blog post to Richard Branson explaining to him why he should let me interview him. And I thought, oh, that's a little embarrassing, I don't know, and decided instead to sort of write up a case of why I wanted to do the interview, what I was going to ask, other interviews that I had done previously, because I was working on my Future Good book, and so I'd been talking to people that were in his sort of network that he had heard of. And so I added that I had interviewed those people, and I sent it to the person that knew that I didn't have a plan, and his boss. And his boss didn't know that I didn't have a plan, and so he forwarded it to the Virgin Communications team, that said, oh, sure, like, sounds like she's got a good platform. She's interviewed these other people that we know that he knows and trusts, so you can get 15 minutes. And so it was fantastic. If I hadn't have done the platform work beforehand, I wouldn't have had the relationships with the national organizations. I wouldn't have had other things to point to, and I couldn't have leveraged that platform and that expertise to be able to have that experience.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it's the hard work you do building the platform from the groundwork. But also, you know, it's not just building the platform and waiting for things to happen. It's building the right. It's building the platform and using it, you know, having the courage to ask, having the courage to reach out, and, you know, and make a strong business case for yourself. That's a great story. So
the one other piece that I'll say about that is that, because I knew it was an important platform moment, I hired a film crew to come and to do the interview instead of doing it on my phone, as I normally would, and really sort of invested the dollars into creating a piece that I have now on my blog at TristaHarris.com, and I have it on my LinkedIn page, and so it brings a lot of credibility for other things. Yeah. And then after that interview, received an invite from his team to present at a conference on his island about the future of doing good. And so when you sort of reach out and pull people into your networks, then it adds to your platform, but then that you don't know how big that reach is going to go.
Yeah. It's such a wonderful story. I mean, that you ended up doing that. And this really, now, was this the impetus for your book? So you have a book called Future Good, which is wonderful. And there's a lot of great advice in there about, you know, moving to the future you want. I mean, you write compellingly about the pull of a future vision. And this applies to philanthropic goals, but I think it probably also applied in your sense to your pull of your vision of what you wanted to do with your career, with what you wanted to do.
For sure. I think Future Good is a great resource for your organization as it's thinking about how to sort of lay out your ideal future. What is it that we want this to look like, and what are the steps that we have to take to get there, and what are the future trends that we can start to pay attention to and harness to get there? But I found time after time that it is, those same tools are so useful on the personal side, as you're considering what some of the challenges are that you might be facing in the future, or what some of the opportunities are. And I've heard from a lot of friends as we're going through all this coronavirus crisis and that sort of thing, that I have been able to bounce back a lot quicker. So in the beginning, it was very panic and what's going to happen and how is this going to work? But then very quickly move to, how do I leverage this moment to create the most good? So this is an opportunity for things like universal basic income and universal health care and paying an affordable wage and paid sick time to minimum wage workers, it really shines a bright light on a lot of things that are possible. And if you are able to understand that these moments are opportunities because it fits into the larger future that you want to create, then you actually know what work to do in times of crisis where it can get really easy to just get stuck in the muck.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. I mean, this is so timely. With a future vision, you can see a way through what we're in now and see how this, like you said, can be an opportunity or actually a, you know, unexpected step on the path towards these other things.
Yeah.
You have a phrase in the book that you talk about that just resonated so much with me, which is very appropriate to the moment, which is being persistently adaptable.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're all living in at this very moment.
That's exactly what we need, right?
Yeah, it's not about adapting once. And I was telling some friends that, you know, for the last couple of years, I've been saying that the pace of change is exponential and we're right at the knee of that curve where it really starts to shoot up and change happens faster than you can even imagine. But we have really felt that curve over the last couple of weeks and we'll continue to feel it where, you know, I wrote a blog post at the beginning of March that was laying out some scenario planning opportunities for people in the social sector around coronavirus and thinking about your role as an employer and your role as somebody that provides programming or provides grant making. And then what do you do in those roles if coronavirus doesn't actually impact your local community, but there is fear about it? Or what if it expands greatly and really developing your strategies for each of those things? And I was looking at that with a client last week and we were like laughing about like how naive it seemed. Like, oh, if it doesn't spread, that's adorable.
No.
And so now we've changed it to if quarantine lasts for, less than 6 weeks or more than 6 weeks, like, yeah. It's that opportunity to really kind of double down on scenario planning. As you have more and more information, those scenarios come to life in a different way. But when things are uncertain, it gives you clarity about what the possibilities are.
Right, right. That's good. And that's the scenario planning being such an important way to deal with. You know, we don't thrive in uncertainty, and scenario mm-hmm. planning gives us a way to put some, you know, create some narratives, create some plans that work.
It narrows those futures. So instead of a million possible futures, it's what are the four possible futures and what would my plan be in each of them? Mm-hmm. And then as it gets clearer, then you just do those things. And often what I find is there's similar strategies that exist in each of those scenarios and you need to just start doing that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So now tell me a little bit about Future Good Society, which is...
Yeah. Yep. So I have a couple different ways for folks to connect. I host these things called Field Trips to the Future, where you can see the future in action. There's a saying the future already exists, but it's not evenly distributed.
Yep.
So I've taken groups to Sweden to see the future of early childhood education. They have a beautiful system of supporting families and kids that's really one of the best in the world. So I brought a group of funders and nonprofit leaders and elected officials from the United States to Sweden to see what it looked like in action and envision what would be possible in our local communities. I've done a field trip to the future to Brazil to see the future of racial equity and really think about lessons learned from around the world when it comes to ending disparities across a ton of different things. And then I'll be hosting one next year to South Africa that is also going to have an equity theme. And I think we're also going to have an environmental piece tied to that. Cape Town almost ran out of water last year. And so there's a lot of work that's been happening there to think about how to be more climate resilient that I think will be really useful for funders and nonprofits that are in the United States. So I want to create these spaces and networks where people together can imagine what the future looks like and see examples of that future being successful.
Wow. You are doing work that is clearly very meaningful to you. It is very meaningful to the world at large. So it's very cool to see. It's great to hear about. What advice would you give to someone who is trying to, you know, find their own place, doing meaningful work, living their purpose?
Yeah, I think one of the pieces is to imagine the legacy that you want to leave behind. And so some people do that through brainstorming. There's an activity that I encourage people to think about, which is the lottery imagination exercise. So you shouldn't play the lottery. It's a poor people tax. But when you see those signs that say $400 million, you start to imagine what your life might look like and how that would feel. And it isn't about all the bucket list stuff, and I'd go here and I'd buy my parents a home and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It's what do you do 2 years later? What do you do 5 years later when money isn't an issue, but you still have time to fill? And I think once you start to dig deeper in that space of how would you fill your time and how would you live out your purpose if you didn't have these outside constraints, it can really give you a vision of the work that you're doing now. And it can give you clarity about what that platform is that you're trying to build. Who are the supporters and kind of people in your network that you would need to make that vision possible? And how are you connecting with them? Is it through a blog? Is it through a podcast? Is it through social media? Where are the places that those people congregate? And how can you become visible in those spaces?
Yeah, that's great. So it's not a, you know, as you have so clearly demonstrated, it's not the matter of the size of your audience. It's a matter of who's in them. It's a matter of that who you're reaching. And in fact, you don't necessarily need that lottery ticket to start making the human connections that can make this all possible.
I had a funny experience. I was with my son, who's a teenager, and we were out getting grilled cheese sandwiches, and somebody walked up to me and she said, "Oh, I read your book. It's so fantastic. I work at this local nonprofit organization." And she said to my son, "How does it feel to have a mom that's so famous?" And he was like, "She is not." And I said, "I am for sure not famous, but in the smallest of small networks, I am very well known." So it's that piece of who are your people? And it's not about the whole world knowing you. For me, it's people that do good for a living are my core audience, and people that I care deeply about and give good content to and good resources because I want to see them be successful. And so they stay connected to me because they want access to those networks and relationships and resources. So I think in building a platform, you can really give back to people that you care about because you're providing them with the resources that are built exactly for them. But I think when people get into that space of, I just want everybody to know who I am and I have 2 million followers on Twitter and all of those sort of things, I think you're probably not getting your message across because everybody isn't your person. Who are your people?
Yeah. Yeah, that's brilliant. That's the thing that people just have to keep their eye on, and you demonstrate it so beautifully with your story. It's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to encourage people to look at your book, Future Good, particularly if you're working in an organization, a nonprofit, something to look to see. But I also encourage you to think about, the people to apply your lesson of looking at the future and let the vision of a strong future pull you forward through generosity. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. And I'm so glad that you're doing this great work to help people build those platforms. I am always so surprised when you see sort of social media or reality show stars that have this big like public relations machine behind them. And I'm like, why am I hearing what you're doing today? That's not interesting to me. And I get really excited when I find people that are sort of in their sphere of influence and using those same tools, but to make the world a better place. So thank you for helping people do that.
Oh, that's great. Thanks.